Hey everyone, welcome in to another daily editorial here on the KE Report. In this daily editorial, Shad and I are chatting with Chris Ritchie, president of Silvercrest Metals. Silvercrest Metals is traded on the TSX under the symbol SIL and on the NYSE under the symbol SILV. Now, Chris, before we get into some of the company-specific updates when it comes to the Las Chispas construction and also drilling that's ongoing, I want to talk more macro environment when it comes to metals and also markets trading, starting off with recent fund flows. It's something you and I have talked about in prior interviews and something you stay very on top of. We were chatting about this off mic, so I don't want to steal your thunder here. Share with us some of the data that you have seen in terms of funds, where they're putting money, and just how much money is flowing out of these funds into markets.
Sure. I read a really interesting piece a couple weeks ago from the Macro Tourist. If anyone's not on that, they should subscribe. Kevin's a really, really bright guy. He was kind of looking at the overall market and sort of just acknowledging, like, where's money going? And he's saying, like, the bond market is so dangerous right now. And then he was also talking about the equity market, trying to hedge your portfolio is so dangerous. But people have flown into the equity markets at record levels. So I saw a data point the other day that talked about the H1 inflows, if you were to annualize those inflows, and this is into the global equity markets, that it would be equivalent to the last 20 years of inflows combined. So again, I kind of use that reference to the bond market. It's, you know, that 60-40 traditional portfolio is really not that applicable when you've got, you know, negative real rates. And again, for people less familiar with that real rate term, you know, right now you've got, you know, 10-year bond that, you know, kind of hovering at 1.25, 1.5, I'm not sure where it is today. But you've got inflation running at over 5%. So putting your money away for 10 years to get 1.5% per year, while your money loses 5% per year on the purchasing power, really is a scary thing. So in the U.S., one of the big acronyms that is TINA, which is There Is No Alternative. So, you know, it's not just gold and silver, it's not just crypto, you know, people are trying to find places to put their money, you know, and you've seen it in real estate. You know, one of the other things that we also chatted about off mic was how the Fed's actually calculating their inflation. So for example, there's a thing called owner's equivalent rent. So, you know, CPI that the government calculates includes home prices. But for those that are renting, they're trying to find something that's owner's equivalent. So they're only calculating that I think it's roughly 2.3% increase in rents, which I think is probably not overly accurate. And the weighting they have on this particular metric within their basket is over 20%. So again, when you look at the CPI numbers now, like these sorts of little data points, you know, suggest that, you know, the actual inflation rate is running much hotter. So I think, again, it's trying to figure out, you know, what that means. And I mean, I know we've talked about this in the past where we have a chart in our macro deck that looks at 100 years of data points and looks at PE multiples in the market when inflation is running hot. And the general idea is that the higher that inflation goes, the lower the PE multiples. So we're in this really strange spot where inflation's running hot. The market really hasn't grasped onto it yet. We've got this amazing backstop of fund flow as well as the government's backstop that they just keep coming in, and that the market hasn't found its own two feet. And this whole idea of what's going on with the Delta variant or the economy opening back up. Well, if the economy opens back up, what if the Fed stops stimulating the market or supporting the market? I mean, right now, another data point I saw was that the Fed is a buyer of approximately 75% of their own debt. So the demand from the Fed is artificially creating these low interest rate environments. You know, you've seen a lot of global players actually sell the US dollar. So the Fed is sort of the buyer of last resort for their own debt. So if the economy is doing great, what's the need for them to continually support the market? So that, you know, we've all sort of seen these sort of headlines. Why, you know, lots of cash in people's pocket, why are we supporting it? So we're in this weird spot where if the market opens up again, if they stop supporting the market, the interest rates go higher, you know, and that's going to be a dangerous thing for the situation. If they keep supporting the market, like this $3.5 trillion stimulus package, are we ever going to get off of this? because it's obviously become politically expedient to, you know, spend money and get credit for it and keep yourself in power. So I think we're in this really, really weird spot. And all the while, the precious metals market had its worst H1 since 1982. So, you know, fund flow is quite fickle into the space. So it's been the most ever for the broader market. And I think it's probably pretty safe to say that, you know, fund flows and ETFs in the gold space are down about 4.5 to 5% on a year-to-date basis. And then for the equities, even more. So, you know, this dovetails, I think, a little bit into how we've tried to manage our business. But yeah, on the macro side there, Corey, there's a lot of really volatile scenarios out there. There's a lot of them that are extremely supportive for the precious metal market. at least they talk about it, but it really hasn't come through just yet.
Yeah, Chris, one of the things that you brought up earlier on there was that it's not a good environment for savers because they're really not making anything. They'd be losing money to the inflation. And as you mentioned, the inflation numbers are probably much higher than how the government is reporting them based on how they figured out those metrics and how that renter's numbers figure in there. There's a lot that they don't calculate in the CPI. So my question to you would be, in this environment where we're seeing inflation running so much hotter and where real rates are actually getting more negative because the 10-year is down pretty low now while inflation's pretty high, that's typically an environment where the precious metals do really well. That's where gold and silver tend to shine. So why do you think it is that the fund flows have been piling into the equities, but not piling into gold and silver as a safe haven from the erosion of inflation?
David Tepper has an interesting video I saw on Zero Hedge maybe about a month ago now, and it was talking about how the global equity market, only 0.75 of 1% is in precious metals. So it's a pretty irrelevant industry. And if you think about a gold company or a silver company, you know, if you get a big production profile, you really can't replenish that portfolio easily. Like, it's just hard to pull all that together. So there's only so big you can get as a precious metals company. And I think what happens is if you're a portfolio manager in the U.S., less than 1% of the benchmark in which your compensation is typically judged against, if less than 1% of that benchmark is in precious metals, gold and silver could go up 50% and you could miss that trade completely and it doesn't matter, right? So there's just really not many resources allocated in the global equity market towards this stuff. Now, this video that David Tepper dug into more, and he said, well, when CPI was running at 3%, that the fund flows went from 0.75% up to 1.2%. So that's, you know, 65-ish percent increase in fund flows into the sector when CPI started to run hot. So, you know, right now, here and now, with all the selling that's gone on for the last decade in the space, if you increase the inflows to the sector by that much, it would be parabolic moves to the space. If you see inflation running at 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and this thing really gets going, it won't take much money to really get it going. So it's an unloved space. I think one of the other data points that's really interesting is this sector has had negative free cash flow for about 25, 30 years. And I know I've used this quote before. I was in the sell side for a long time and I had a boss tell me he loves resource companies because they're great at destroying capital and they need to come back. So investors have said, None of this. We don't want it anymore. You need to show us absolute free cash flow and good return on invested capital strategies. And they've had to do that. So you saw Kinross last week that's doing a $300 million buyback. Humana announced another buyback and a dividend bump. Pan American Silver just announced their third divvy bump in the last 18 months. So the average P to NAV multiple in the sector right now is 0.8. The average over the last 25 years is 1.5. So this has been totally ignored and it's cyclical. I mean, that's the nature of these sectors. They're called cyclical. So it's a small, often ignored sector that once the momentum starts, that's when the next turn and look at it. So now it's a matter of, you know, how are people sort of navigating it in the short to medium term. But I think because not much exploration has been done over the last 10, 20 years, that these big producing companies need to replenish those portfolios. And I think M&A is going to be a much bigger theme. And it also helps with, you know, the dynamic that asset managers need much bigger positions and much bigger companies, because again, their margins are getting squeezed as fees come down. So they need more assets under management in order to keep their own top line flat. So it's not really a relevant industry. And I think some of that push towards scale is required. The return on invested capital and free cash flow. I think right now you've probably got an industry average of about 8 to 10% free cash flow yields in the space and almost pristine balance sheets. So the sector has never been cheaper and the sector has never been healthier, but there's just not that many eyeballs on it.
Yeah, that's the balance, isn't it? The sector has cleaned itself up, especially the majors. But fact of the matter is, people are distracted by other sectors. And it doesn't take much to move this sector, but it also takes some cash flow coming in. So we just aren't there quite yet. Chris, let's shift focus a little bit to what's going on with Silvercrest Metals. Let's start with the construction update from Las Chispas. That came out just a couple days ago on August 10th. What updates can you give us as this construction build-out progresses?
Yeah, so this was a really big deal for us. We were really happy to sort of be able to finally give the market an update on how we're doing. And the long and short of it is we're on time and we're on budget so far. And, you know, you can imagine if anyone's tried to build a house before or any other major project, if you get behind early, you know, you've got other people that are paid to show up on a certain time. And if they're just sitting around waiting till you finish one aspect of the project to start another, you're double paying. So there's a cascading or compounding effect when you get behind. So the fact that we've gotten the earthworks, the concrete, it's predominantly done, the camps all set up, a lot of those major projects, progressing very well, is a major de-risking amount. The idea here is about 80% of the total capital will be spent by year end. So again, it's we're hoping to be in production in Q2 next year. Some of the other things that are definitely worth highlighting, about half of the total capital is under what's called an EPC contract. So again, that stands for engineering, procurement, construction. So Ausenco, who's doing a great job for us, if there's an overrun, they pay for it. So again, this was a contract negotiated during COVID. So, I mean, they would have taken their pound of flesh and contingency and whatnot. And that contingency is showing up, or maybe it's not contingency, but those risks are showing up. I mean, our steel costs went up by about 40-45%. Now, thankfully for us, it's, you know, roughly 700,000 going to a little over a million, so it's not material. But it does show you that our low CapEx number really is important versus other companies that need to go spend 3, 4, 5, 6, 700 million and are exposed to these inflationary issues. Some of our wage increases, I mean, our exploration team, there's people that don't make a lot of money down there, but, you know, some of those wages were going up like 15-ish%. Now, again, on an absolute basis, it's maybe 150 grand higher as a total team. But you're seeing wage increases going up across the industry. So that's a big issue. Time and logistics, everything was great so far for us, knock on wood. So we don't have any major issues there. We do have one small issue that, you know, when you're building a power line, there's a sort of a voltage regulation system. So that last mile from the power line to the operation, that we're getting what we need at the right rate. That system's a bit delayed. But for us, you know, we have backup diesel gensets. So again, not a major issue as of now. The biggest one, and this is for the actual underground development, is recall that we started our underground development early in 2019. So we took a gamble to say that this was going to be an economic mine, all in the name of de-risking. We wanted to have as many different working faces available, different veins that we could draw ore from. We wanted to have, you know, a lot of stockpiles sitting on the ground when we start the mill so that we don't have to put a lot of pressure on the mining rates. Recall, if anyone's seen our feasibility study, that we don't actually plan to be pulling 100% of the ore from the underground until the end of our third full year. So again, really taking pressure off there. So, you know, our veins are fairly narrow, you know, it's probably as little as 0.8 meters up to like, you know, 3, 4, 5 meters. But again, that means each vein can only pull so much tonnage per day. So the more veins that we have available to go to, is a very significant de-risking event. So I'm trying to remember that off the top of my head. I think we did about 4 kilometers in the first half of this year, but we've done about 14 kilometers, so I think it's 13.1, since we started underground development. So we're well advanced. We're ahead of schedule on that, which is fantastic. And again, we hope to have that 9 months of stockpile on surface. So imagine going to a vein and then realizing, oh man, the grade's lower here than you thought. It's lower here than what was in the study. Well, then we hopefully will have the option of going to other veins that have better grade, and we can manage that risk, you know. Or if there's veins that we have access to that are higher grade than what's in the current mine plan, you know, if we're 2 months into a quarter and looks like we're going to be a little bit below production, you know, we can go into an area with higher grade and access some of that material. So again, from a de-risking standpoint, a lot of companies sometimes end up being, you know, 2, 3, 4 months ahead of production with what they're doing for development. We want to be 1 to 2 years ahead of production with our development. So that's going extremely well. You know, our COVID camp has been was a really great decision by the team. We built a 520 person, you know, unit building. So again, most miners live with 40 people per unit. For us, it's all single occupancy. Right, they live on site. We bought our own PCR test. They come to Hermosillo to get tested. They stay for a day of quarantine. You get tested. You wait for the results. You go directly to site, and then while on site, you're still doing social distancing. Right, there was, you know, a couple mining companies. I know Fortuna was the latest one I saw that had about a 17% reduction in their corporate level guidance because they had an outbreak. So for us, that risk mitigation is significant. So we have 2 months of contingency built into our timeline on the build. We haven't had to use any of that yet. And again, largely because of the protocols we've had in place. So the mill's looking great. The underground development's ahead of schedule. The COVID camp is helping out. We've got some buffer on that side of things. And also accessing this material so you can test your mining methods, test your recoveries and metallurgical studies, like that's pretty unique to be this far ahead on that. So again, more de-risking coming from that side. So all those things, you know, knock on wood, are doing fantastically well. And when you combine that with how we've structured the company on the balance sheet side, again, we're hoping to give confidence to people on that front. So if everyone recalls, we raised $40 million capital just as a corporate level buffer, things like COVID or a pandemic. So that's there. You know, 2022 is our ramp up year, and we're expected to have approximately $33 million in revenue at $19 silver, $1,500 gold. So that amount we assumed was, hey, we screwed it up. You know, we screwed it up. We have to spend more money in the mill and the recoveries aren't working. So we assume that number is zero. So for us, that means we raised an additional $35 million on top of the 40 for that component. And again, we also raised an additional $50 million for what's called a value add tax. And that value add tax is 16% of all goods and services. And then the Mexican government says, thanks, we'll take that for a while, and then we'll pay you back manana, manana. So we did not rely upon that capital coming back to us in any sort of useful time frame from a CapEx perspective. So that's going out the door. That's ours. That will come back. But we don't know when. Typically, it's probably within 2 years. So, you know, when you think about our free cash flow profile that's seemingly on track right now, our first full year of production, we're anticipated to have $160 million of project-level free cash flow. So that means it's before your G&A, which is roughly 10. So take that 160 down to 150. Maybe we'll spend, you know, 20-ish million on drilling. I'm just making up a number there. So 150 now goes to 130. And then we're going to pull about $90 million a debt. So if you subtract $90 million from the 130, you know, that leaves us about $40 million. So that's that $19 silver and $1,500 gold. But all that corporate level contingency, the 40 just the corporate level, that 35-ish, you know, if we don't use it to sort of, you know, fix some mistakes that might get made, or that $50 million of value add tax, that money or some portion of that money comes back on to that amount of free cash flow we have. So this transition that we're going through right now from exploration, development, let's get the mine ramped up next year, and then free cash flow. It's all happening really fast. So I think that's one major, you know, portion of what we're focused on. And we wanted to give investors confidence that, hey, the market stays soft. Okay, no big deal. You know, hey, if we make some mistakes, okay, they've got the capital and they've got the team and this asset can support it. You know, and one other thing that I think is very interesting to bring up, and this is for people who've heard me yammer on for the last couple of years, is in May of last year, and this is mid-May after that pandemic financing we did, and then we ended up doing a private placement a few weeks later. So I chose mid-May of 2020 for a reason, and that reason is it was 50% higher share price than that private placement that we did. So at that time, we would have been at all-time highs. You know, we had a good balance sheet, we're at all-time highs, and that price point was $8.80 U.S., and that's similar to the $9.20 US where we just raised capital back in February. So I went back and I tested how much stock has traded above those levels. And that number is $4 billion US. So anyone who doesn't like construction and they don't like the risk, these are people that said, hey, we made money on your financings in the exploration phase. High fives all around. I didn't get too many people buying me beers. I'm gonna cash in on those post-COVID. But we didn't, you know, those people took their profits, but now we're trading kind of about 15% below those levels. And now the risk is starting to, you know, be ticked off the box. So when you get to the end of Q3, Q4, knock on wood, if we're still able to be showing the progress that we're currently showing and we're looking forward to that free cash flow, you know, what happens if only 10 or 20% of those particular shareholders or those that $4 billion that was sold, if they come back to be buyers? So my strategy now, actually, for anyone listening, is I don't need people to be massive bulls on silver. I'm hoping any sellers at higher levels are saying, hey, we navigated phase one well, phase two seems to be going pretty well. I'm going to go buy 25% of a position. And if it goes lower, I'm going to buy another 25% of a position. It goes lower, you know, I'm comfortable enough to buy another 25%, again, because of the team, because of the asset, because of the balance sheet, you know, because of that fixed price contract. And hopefully it's a little bit of first come, first serve. You know, I do want to get to the point where the big buyers that need to see cash flow, you know, are waiting, but they're also coming into a stock where there just isn't that much free float, right? So again, we want to be risk averse. We want people to be able to look at the long game. Right. And then, you know, depending on the time here, I mean, we can chat a little bit about the drilling and the long term growth, but hopefully that makes some sense in terms of how we're trying to structure the company and how we're progressing at site.
Absolutely. Chris, I think you laid that out pretty well. And really, the summary here is that you guys are just making sure that you have the ability, right, to weather any sort of pullback and that shareholders can understand that you guys are prepared for any hiccups that might happen, but also continuing to move forward here. We are running a little bit long, so we're going to wrap it up here, Chris, but I'll bring you back on in the next week or two and we'll get some more questions answered and we'll dive a bit more into the drilling. So if anybody has any questions on the drilling or any of the production and construction updates that we got here, please email us either fleck@kereport.com or shad@kereport.com, and we will get those answered for you in a subsequent interview in the next couple weeks. Chris, thank you for your time. I appreciate the update. We'll chat again soon.
Excellent. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.